it looks like we have a forum to bring the meeting to order, Public Security Policy and Finance Committee, and start out with a roll call.
Representative Cornish.
Here.
Representative Johnson.
Here.
Representative Hillstrom.
Here.
Representative Becker Finn.
Here.
Representative Considine.
Here.
Representative Dean. Representative Frankie.
Here.
Representative Grossel.
Here.
Representative Howe. Representative Lomer.
Here.
Representative Lucero. Representative Neuberger. Representative O'Neill. Representative Pinto.
Here.
Representative Ward. Representative Zerwis.
Okay, everybody. Entertain a motion to approve the minutes from January 18th.
I'll do it again.
Representative Considine makes a motion to approve the minutes of January 18th. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, motion carried. Okay, folks, we start out today with an overview of the Peace Officer Standards of Training Board, known as the POST Board, with the Executive Director. Go ahead, sir, your name and title, and begin.
Thanks a lot, Chairman Cornish and members. My name is Nate Gove. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Peace Officer Standards and Training, known as the POST Board. We are the state's regulatory agency that licenses approximately 12,000 officers in Minnesota. Our mission is also to adopt and regulate the education, selection, licensing, and training standards. Prior to my service with the POST Board, I was a peace officer in Minnesota for just under 29 years. The POST Board was created back in 1977 and replaced the Minnesota Peace Officer Training Board, which was established by the state approximately 1967. The slide shows what our enabling powers and duty legislation cites, as well as our administrative rules. Minnesota continues to be, in my experience traveling around the country, representing the Minnesota POST Board as a national leader in the level of education and ongoing education and training that our licensed officers receive. We are the first occupational licensing system within the country. And it's interesting that when I look at reciprocal out-of-state officers looking to come to Minnesota, we see that quite frequently, and recently it seems like it's been from the southwest warmer states where officers are, their agencies are seeking Minnesota officers. So I think they're playing the weather against us a little bit. So why the change? The state certainly has a very decentralized law enforcement state. Has a vested interest in ensuring that the professional law enforcement and consistent police practices are really statewide between Greater Minnesota and the Metro. Certainly communities that have more resources, we want to make sure that there's a certain minimal level of professionalism and standard that all Minnesotans can count on. And this partnership really started with the creation of the POST Board to ensure this with higher education. And currently, there are a number of pathways to become licensed in Minnesota, but at a minimum, you need a two-year post-secondary degree and attend a professional peace officer education program. So a two- or four-year college degree. Minnesota has currently 32 professional peace officer program locations throughout the state, and about 29 colleges and universities that the POST Board oversees and certifies. So the results are, we've really set the level as Minnesota and its officers being professionals, and that a significant percentage of the current working officers have four-year college degrees. A recent study, in the late 2000s, at that time, there was nearly 50% of the working officers in Minnesota had bachelor's degrees, and we estimate that is far higher, as well as advanced degrees as well. If you look at the number of colleges that have police leadership master's programs, have grown exponentially over the years. I myself am a product of this system as well. So back when our board was doing our strategic, our five-year strategic planning, we wanted to ensure that our current business processes and regulatory responsibilities, as well as our responsibilities as a resource to all of our different stakeholders, that our mission reflected that. And I spoke to that in the opening, but again, it's to really adopt and regulate the education, the selection standards, the ongoing training standards, and the licensing standards of all peace officers in Minnesota, from game wardens to municipal officers to sheriff's deputies. We perform a unique public service as a regulatory board, but we also serve as a resource to our stakeholders. And if you look at the list of stakeholders, it's very wide and varied. From the courts to the League of Minnesota Cities, the media, the public, the governor's office, certainly the legislature, and the licensees themselves, as well as the colleges and universities that provide the entry-level education. Key services for the Post Board is licensing and relicensing all of our officers in Minnesota. And this slide shows you what the current number is as of yesterday for licensed, actively working peace officers in Minnesota, just over 10,700. There's another 1,300 officers that maintain their license in an inactive status. And that essentially means they're not currently employed as a peace officer, but they maintain their 48 hours of continuing education every 3 years. Key service strategies, and this has been an area in my short tenure that I focused on to make improvements and refocus on accountability, is one is we create and we administer licensing exams. And the Post Board is currently in the process of rewriting our licensing exam in a computer-based format, which will add to convenience for not only candidates seeking employment, but the agencies that want a quick turnaround of their license results, as well as a more robust licensing schedule. And that's the result of, in April of 2015, the board completely rewrote our learning objectives, almost 700 of them, with increased focus on crisis response, community and cultural diversity recognition, as well as mental health strategies. Part of the learning objectives beyond just the academic, the why we're doing something and the what we're doing, is the how, the practical skills as well, the different strategies in dealing with some of the challenges we've seen recently. The Post Board is aware of that and actually put these changes in place back in April of 2015. They will be fully rolled out at the universities beginning the fall semester of 2017. We also monitor agency compliance to make sure they have their mandated policies and procedures, and we conduct on-site compliance reviews of the police agencies. And over the last 2 years, our agency did nearly 300 on-site visits of law enforcement agencies. It's jump-starting a new strategy that all agencies are visited every 5 years by a Post Board standards coordinator to ensure that they're meeting appropriate legislative policies and laws concerning use of force and other in-service mandated training. And lastly, we manage the training reimbursement fund. So in fiscal year 16, we returned about 8% of the total reported costs that law enforcement agencies reported us that they spend on ongoing in-service police training. We returned just over $2.8 million to 385 local units of government. Here's our agency statistics. So as a statewide regulatory agency, ensuring the standards and the compliance with our laws and rules is no small task. As of today, we have 437 law enforcement agencies statewide, between municipal, sheriffs, tribal, non-municipal PDs, and state agencies. Of this number, you should know that 25% of these agencies have seven or less officers. And think about the ability for an agency of seven, five, six officers to provide 24-hour public safety coverage to their communities. It's a challenge, and all the resources that go into having a fully functioning police department or sheriff's office. In Minnesota, we have 19 agencies that have one officer. So clearly they don't have 24-hour coverage and must partner with their local sheriff's offices. But quite often those agencies in those locations also have very low staffing on the sheriff's offices, their rural communities. Two-thirds of Minnesota's agencies have 25 officers or less. So Minnesota is a very decentralized law enforcement state with a lot of grassroots local control over their public safety and public safety services. And since 1990, there's been 152 agencies that have disbanded, consolidated, or contracted services with their local sheriff's department. Here's our current snapshot of staffing at post. We're down five full-time employees since the early 2000s. A listing of our positions. The staff coordinator, the standards coordinators are the ones that are out in the field and answering the questions concerning compliance. We have a pre-service education coordinator who obviously coordinates with all of the colleges and universities and was responsible for the large project of rewriting our learning objectives with obviously heavy professional input from the law enforcement community as well as the colleges and universities. So our post board, there is a board, 14 members appointed by the governor in staggered terms. The 15th member is the ex officio position. That's the BCA superintendent. The bottom one is currently an open seat. It's a very statutorily specific board seat. Must be an elected official from a city or statutory home rule community outside of the metro area, 5,000 population or less. And that seat was held by the mayor of Winsted, and he has not sought reappointment on the board. In addition, we have two public members. One of those positions is open as well and receiving applications. Post funding, how are we funded? Through the special revenue account on surcharges on certain criminal and traffic convictions. This has been amended over time. The original surcharge was $25. It is now $75. Post has funded 39% of the original $25 surcharge, which is $9.75. So of $65 of the $75 current surcharge goes back to the general fund for other purposes. The DNR receives 1% of the surcharge. This is the current reimbursement as of fiscal year 16 was $312 per officer. There's just over 9,100 officers in Minnesota that met the requirements to receive this reimbursement. And as I pointed out in the Judiciary Committee yesterday, in spite of a lot of focus on law enforcement about training needs and training and different hats that law enforcement needs to wear and some of the situations that they're being second-guessed on, it's interesting that between 2015 and 2016, the per officer share went down over $20. So it continues to decline, and over the last 15 years, there's been a net decline of over $150 per share. For fiscal year 17.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilstrom has a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So if I could get clarification, so the state used to pay $477 for training, and now the state pays $312. Is that what you just said?
Mr. Wilson.
Yes, Representative Hilstrom, that's correct. The high was 477. At that time, there were less officers in Minnesota, which does figure into the quotient, but we were at 312 for last year.
Okay, Director Goldfrid.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Our budget for fiscal year 17 is just over $4.2 million. You can see the amount that comes from the original special revenue surcharge. There is an additional statutory appropriation on a reinstatement fee for driver's license suspensions. That continues to decline from a high of just under $500,000 back when this law was added in 07. To this year, we estimated $125,000. And there's one additional one-time legislative appropriation for training and de-escalation and crisis response to emotionally disturbed persons. This $100,000 expires at the end of fiscal year 17. And you can see what our current estimate is for the our overall budget, what will go back to local units of government. Typically, it runs between 70 to 75%. Chairman Cornish, that's all I have. I would be happy to answer any questions that you or members may have.
In general, Director Grove, through your past history and through your tenure here and talking with other states on their training, how do we set nationally as far as training compared to other states, professionalism and training, you think, in Minnesota compared to other states?
My experience has been Minnesota, with its required CEs every 3 years, that we certainly provide a great deal of opportunities for training, but there is disparity between Greater Minnesota and the Metro, certainly, on money that's available for local units of government. I still maintain my travels. Minnesota has some of the highest trained and educated officers. Other states are still centralized academy where they come back for 3 days or 1 week of training, and that's it. Minnesota, it's ongoing, and with another initiative to now start tracking continuing education credits again after a 15-year hiatus from it, beginning July 1st, we're going to have a much better picture as to just how much officers exceed the 48 minimum CE requirement.
Okay. Thank you, Director. Before we get into questions, I just want to make an announcement. We have had a request for public testimony today. We're not going to allow public testimony. We have a long history of when we do agency overviews. We don't usually get into that. If we bring a bill up in the future that has something to do with what the group would like to address, we're sure welcome to the table and have them sign up. But today will just be agency overviews and questions by our members. We've got quite a list here. Representative Frankie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cove, I'm hearing in my area that there's a big need for hands-on training facilities. Is that something that you're hearing statewide?
Director?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I have not heard that personally, other than just at times agencies that may not have as cooperative of an agreement with their local agencies to band together. But my experience has been that many take advantage of colleges and universities that provide the training to smaller agencies, as they're already providing the training for pre-service students. Others have very good working relationships with their sheriff's offices to bring in the smaller agencies. So it's a matter of that's very expensive, and I have not heard a specific need regionally on that.
Okay. Thank you.
Hey, Representative Frankie, any follow-up?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cole, I do have kind of a follow-up that follows. What do you see is the biggest need in getting our officers the training that they, I guess I would say, deserve?
Well, from our standpoint, Representative, Mr. Chair, is that certainly $312 per officer is not appropriate. It is going in the wrong direction. And if you send an officer to just 8 hours of emergency vehicle training up at St. Cloud or Dakota County, that's around $300, if not more. That does not even take into account travel time, and I'm thinking Greater Minnesota. I mean, we have a lot of training in the metro and facilities. Outstate, there is travel time, but it is more to get to those areas such as the Hibbings or Duluth, where, or the St. Clouds or Wilmer, where larger agencies would be hosting training.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Carter. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
For the members' information, we'll probably have a or will have a bill coming with quite a large sum of money ask or request for officers training in crisis intervention training and dealing with mentally disturbed people and suicide. And I think if it hasn't been introduced, it will be soon. And so we'll look forward to hearing that bill here and hearing more about that. Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Ranke, for your presentation. I was just curious on if you're seeing any changes in enrollment numbers for police officers. It's a rather challenging time to be an officer, and just are we seeing any declines or staying about the same, or do you address that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lohmer, we have done a recent survey of the colleges and universities, and some anecdotally, it's difficult for them to track because the method we use to track as to how many people are entering the law enforcement profession is at the point that they sign up and actually take the licensing exam. Because people come in, they fluctuate out, they might even go through the program, not seek employment, or shift midstream into probation, dispatching, corrections, and the schools have difficult time tracking people. So do you want to be a police officer? Some have reported a drop in enrollment in law enforcement programs. I think that also may have some indication with the economy coming back. But we have seen a slight decline in the number of people taking our licensing exam. And we'll be watching that closely as that, if that continues to fall, I think that'd be more of a statistical indicator of a drop in interest in actually becoming license eligible to be a peace officer.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Representative Bloomer, go ahead.
Thank you. So the number was about 10,000 licensed, I think you said. How does that compare to last year or the last couple of years?
Well, interesting. Mr. Chair, Representative Lohmer, it's 10,700 that are actively working, and that is higher than it was last year. But we may have more officers coming into retirement age who some have argued because of some of the intense scrutiny have decided that it's time to retire, and they're happy to do so. We don't track when people retire. We just only track when they terminate their employment with the agency.
Hey, Representative.
Can I ask a follow up on that point?
Representative Hilstrom to this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So do you have a sense then of what percent of the population is eligible for retirement? I believe the state, in general, state employees, one-third of the population could retire today. Do you have a sense of what the population of eligible for retirement is in law enforcement?
Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilstrom, I do not have that number. I would be happy to see what we could pull up on that. It may be a question of asking PARA how many new law enforcement officers have asked for to now start their pension. We don't collect it. We can look at ages of officers and then make some assumptions as to, well, they're eligible, but certainly the current number of officers that are licensed is much higher than it was at the same time last year.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Director Grove, for being here. I have a couple of questions. One focuses around the process, because you all do grant licensees to peace officers. What is the process that an officer on your board would go through for considering revoking a license of an officer, whether it be for conduct in the line of duty or actually even conduct outside of line of duty?
Director.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dean, so the process is an automatic revocation of an officer's license can only occur after due process has been served with a conviction for a felony. So we receive many complaints where the vast majority have to do with complaints that have yet to be adjudicated,
mm-hmm.
or are service delivery complaints that are handled within the employer-employee relationship, the chief or the sheriff. But we take a look at the complaint to see if it meets within our jurisdiction for the board to even have the authority to have a licensee called in before the our complaint committee. We take a look at what the complaint is. It's put before our complaint committee to make a determination if it falls within our jurisdiction based on a staff recommendation. And if it's determined it doesn't fall within our jurisdiction, it is dismissed. But the complaints are forwarded to the chief or the elected sheriff to look into as it is their employee. So many of the complaints we get, while they seem to want to involve the post board, are not, we're not an employer, and we have specific rules that govern what is within our jurisdiction. Gross misdemeanor convictions for, let's say, a gross misdemeanor DWI comes before our complaint committee. Failure to train by a chief or sheriff providing the appropriate training, they come before our committee for potential sanctions, and certainly corrective action.
Representative Dean, follow up.
Follow up directly to that, and then I'll have one more question. So do you all have the authority to recommend or to suspend a license at the press board?
Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, if it comes before the board and it has our authority, the complaint committee, yes.
Okay. And then one last question, Mr. Chair, thank you. So in the past 5 years, do you have any idea of how many you may licenses that may have been revoked or may have been suspended for officers throughout the state?
Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, I've been at the Post Board just over 2 years, and I would have to look. It'd be less than four that I've signed automatic revocation orders on. We do that quite promptly once there's final sentencing by the overseeing judge, and to ensure that it is actually sentenced and meets the conviction definition. And in terms of suspensions, we get those off and on. For instance, if an officer, if we're told by the Revenue Department that they're behind on child support, their license would be suspended until they come back to fully paid. There's been very few of those, but we have taken quite a bit of disciplinary action since I've been there. A lot of it's been corrective in terms of putting agencies under more reporting requirements to ensure that they're getting the appropriate training and working with agencies, not just as a regulatory body, but as a resource to ensure they have the updated policies and serve as a resource for them as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good. Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a real quick question. Second to last slide, you had $100,000 that's going to disappear at the end of 17. Is that money still available? I mean, should I be calling my local police chief and saying, we got some money for training? We had a tragedy in Mankato a couple years back where a young man attacked police with a knife, and is that money still available?
Director?
Mr. Chair, Representative Considine, so that money went to the Upper Midwest Community Policing Institute to provide statewide 8-hour training to peace officers in crisis de-escalation, dealing with people who are emotionally disturbed, in addition to veterans suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder and others. That is began by the legislature with a $50,000 appropriation, I believe, in around 2014. And since then, there's been a $100,000 appropriation at least every year. The goal by the Upper Midwest Community Policing Institute is to train 1,000 officers per year. I think they're closing in on 2,000. So the money is available in the sense that they have statewide courses that they are planning and delivering and have delivered. And I suspect Mankato has taken, or down in your area, has taken advantage of those regionally held courses over the last several years.
Thank you for the explanation.
Thank you. Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Gove, first I wanted to thank you for being available for to help educate the public about the important role you play. You came out to our League of Women Voters in my area and did some education there for folks, and I think that's really helpful for people, especially as we talk about that crisis intervention training. And so the question I had for you is, do you know how many officers currently have the CIT training in the de-escalation or anything related to that? Because I know not all officers currently do.
Director.
Mr. Chair and Representative Becker-Finn, Minnesota CIT officers are closing in on, if not going over, 1,000 officers that have been trained statewide in the 40-hour comprehensive training that CIT, which stands for Crisis Intervention Team. That training is very complex. It involves partnerships with mental health and other advocacy groups to steer people away from the criminal justice system to the healthcare system. The Upper Midwest Community Policing, as I spoke about, wants to have 2,000 officers, which would be, you know, not all of the officers in Minnesota, certainly, but at least hopefully 20%, and they certainly will complete that as well. And I have seen a huge uptick in the number of agencies that are advertising for this 40-hour CIT training for their officers and others that are doing that. So I'm very, for the public to think that there's no ongoing training in this is just not so. And our new learning objectives expand this area quite nicely, and curriculum is being built on this. And the colleges and universities, I mean, they're providing at a minimum 30 hours, if not 50 to 100 in integrated courses about abnormal psychology and communication skills in dealing with mental health and the Americans with Disability Act. All of these things found within our updated learning objectives to get the people who aren't officers yet.
Mr. Chair, if I could ask another related question. Thank you, Director Gove. So just to clarify for the public's benefit, the $312 would be per officer per year. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And then Director Gove, I'm wondering then, again, just I work with officers in Minneapolis as well as Hennepin County. So that dollar amount, as it's gone down, we're talking about officers not only paying for the training and the transportation, but also the man hours that they're away from the streets or investigations or any of their other work.
Director.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative, that's correct. The agencies, smaller agencies, that dollar amount plays a much more significant role in their budget. For some agencies, it's their entire budget. And certainly, if you look at that 40-hour CIT training, in the metro area, that's roughly $600 for the one-week tuition. That doesn't even include backfilling that officer on the street, travel time. Great if you're in the metro, but what if you're in War Road? And, of course, vendors are another issue as well, to actually provide training to over 10,000 officers. And so, as you can see with the grant, over several years going to the Upper Midwest Community Policing Institute, I mean, it's taken them over 2 years just to do roughly 20% of Minnesota's officers. So the costs are significant.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative, to this point?
Yes.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what would it actually cost if the state were to fund the training that we require? Anybody know?
Direct.
How much?
Well, currently, Mr. Chair, Representative Hilstrom, law enforcement is reporting $34 million is what it costs. Last year, we returned just over 2.8. So it was around 8%. And so it's very significant that the amount of training that local governments pay for. And obviously communities that have more resources, they can put a lot more training into it. But the flip side for them as well is they also have a larger area to police, typically in the metro area, more calls for service, and have some real challenges with backfilling their shifts, et cetera.
Maybe I can discuss this bill I've been talking about a little bit. It's in the hopper now. It'll probably come out in the next few days with a number. You folks probably should sign on. But anyway, it's about $9 or $10 million. Sorry if I get some of these figures wrong. It doesn't matter. And what it'll do is the theme behind it is right now the traffic surcharge is paying for a lot of the tickets or a lot of the training. And we want to take that away so we don't get accused of officer writing tickets to finance themselves. So what we'll do is hopefully that's been behind the amount of money we needed for a long time, ever since I've been here. So this money would go into the base of budget and instead of a special revenue fund, part of that money. And that would be used for that training I talked about, the CIT and the suicidal and the mentally disturbed persons. And then there's another provision in the bill that would talks about cultural diversity and hiring different people, making it easier. So it's quite an encompassing bill put out by the law enforcement team, a proactive bill, and I think it'll go over well and go a long way to supplying the money we need to train our 10,000 officers. So.
Just, Mr. Chair, really quick, when will we be able to sign on to that?
Well, if it's in the hopper, when's the, it's been in there, will it be, get a number today?
I'm not sure.
Oh, very soon.
Okay.
We'll have plenty of time. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Grove, I have a couple different comments and some couple different minor questions. First of all, I want to thank you for going back to keeping track of the continuing education hours. That disappeared while I was an officer, and what a nightmare trying to keep track of your hours, and if you get audited, trying to find all the information. A few officers got into trouble because they had the training, but they couldn't prove it. Second of all, I want to thank you for the great job you do on the education part of it. Minnesota, I believe, has the best trained officers in the country. In fact, as you mentioned, we have a number of states that come to Minnesota to our colleges mm-hmm. to recruit our top candidates to take them out of Minnesota and bring them down to their states. Which brings me to one question. I'm just wondering if you know how many of our law enforcement candidates that are in the colleges are getting removed from the state of Minnesota by decent officers out of state in this warm climate.
Director?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, the number is still relatively low. If you go to Alexandria Technical College, they regularly see the Rapid City, South Dakota Police Department at their college stealing officers away to South Dakota, if you will. It's still relatively low, as Minnesota is viewed as a highly professional, well-paid, excellent benefit state to work as a law enforcement officer, and a relatively safe state, comparatively. So the numbers are still relatively low. The vast majority of our students in the pipeline at any given time are roughly 1,300 to 1,700 students that are license eligible, and about a third to a half get hired over about a year's time. And we've actually seen that increase recently, which tells me there probably is something to be said about the number of officers that are retiring and taking their pensions. So I could look and see what our last, it would be contained in our most recent biennial report of fiscal year 15 and 16.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Grove, I know it is a problem with the states. When I was going to school in Hibbing, at least three times a year, Texas, Florida, even Mississippi was up in that college recruiting the students there. So we know they come from all over the country to get the our law enforcement candidates. Another question I have is, I know by statute we mandate quite a few different training requirements. Of the 48 continuing education credits that are required to renew the license, how many hours are we mandated to have in different categories?
Director?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, so currently the only hour requirement is 8 hours of emergency vehicle driving every 5 years. That started out every 3 years, keeping it within the officer's licensing cycle. We do require annual use of force training that must meet the published learning objectives by the board. Those are currently being reviewed as well concerning more specificity around verbal skills de-escalation by a training committee. We don't set an hourly rate at that. My experience is that metro area agencies certainly provide 8 hours a year on that, if not more. Outstate, it can vary from 4 to 6 to 8. But agencies, this is a high area of liability, so they certainly want to ensure their officers are very trained very well and thoroughly in this area. But that's the only hourly requirement of the 3-year 48 CEs that are required.
Mr. Chair, the reason I ask that, I want to make sure, because we have officers that want to get trained in specific areas like computer crimes and some of the trafficking on the sex crimes through the computers. And if we get too many mandated hours, they're not going to be able to get that training because it is expensive. And so I'm concerned about mandating too many training things. The de-escalation training, I've actually sat in on one that we fund for the veterans, and that is a great training course, not just for the veterans, but the officers use it in all the de-escalation because it goes both ways. It's a very good course. And then one issue that I've noticed in my years as a law enforcement officer, most of the training that's put together and the programs that are put together are geared toward the metro area. And once you get outside of the metro area, it's a different world dealing in law enforcement. So I'd like to see some more training set up geared towards greater Minnesota and the people out there, because I believe the officers that we have out there are wonderful. A lot of times, and I've done it myself, gone to the domestics by yourself, dealing with it, hostile situation, one-on-two. And then when you do need to call for help, it might be 15 minutes for the next squad car to get there, if you're lucky. Or down here, if you call for help, you have 25 squad cars shows up in 35 seconds. So I'd like to see some more training geared towards greater Minnesota if there is a way to do that.
Director, any front? Okay, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Out in Wright County, I talk to my sheriff often. I see him all the time, and it seems like every time I talk to him, he always says, oh, I need 6 officers. I still need officers, and I keep sending him people, but he still needs officers. And I'm wondering how widespread is that? That's just, you know, Wright County is the third largest sheriff's department in the state of Minnesota, and they can't find people to fill those slots. It's been at least 3 years, I think he's been telling me, that he needs more folks. And I'm wondering how widespread that is. Is it worse in greater Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, we hear anecdotally various agencies have challenges, certainly as they change in size and population and calls for service, and that there are many factors that really play into that. One of the issues in greater Minnesota, of course, is they say, well, everybody wants to get trained up here and then come down to the metro for higher pay and more activity and more training opportunities. So there are challenges certainly beyond the post board's control. What I can tell you is that the number that we have in the pipeline of students is keeping pace with the demand on a statewide basis. It's not like we have 200 students ready to go, but 1,000 jobs. It is proportional to the current demand, but we will be watching the number that come to take the licensing exam to ensure that as numbers, as the workforce ages, that we have enough students in the pipeline. I think it is helpful that we have 29 programs to provide it regionally, which gets to Representative Johnson's comments about everything just can't be in the metro, and they are regionally situated.
Representative O'Neill. So the folks I keep sending him are veterans, and that's a great fit. You know, these are military-trained men, and they finish up their training maybe at Hennepin Tech or something, and which is up in our area. But, you know, I'm also on the Veterans Committee, so maybe that's something more we can kind of connect together. But it seems like a good fit. At least that's what my sheriff keeps telling me. Send me more of these military-trained men.
Okay. Director, thank you very much. Representative Pinto, did you have a question?
Briefly, Mr. Chair, Director, I had the chance to work with you in the post board and the training I did on sex trafficking. Thank you for that. My question just has to do with the control of the content of courses. My understanding is the post board really is limited to just making sure that courses meet certain minimum standards. This is the your statutory direction. So I guess I kind of wanted to get that confirmed first, my understanding of that.
Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, that's correct. We ensure that it meets our learning objectives, that it meets our board rules, for that it's law enforcement related and meets a need. The Post Board tries not to be the statewide education and training censorship bureau. We realize that there's a lot of different methods for adult instruction and in-service training. We want to make sure it's not something way off the grid, but give sort of flexibility to training providers as long as they meet our rules, which have served us very well to provide the training and let the free market a little bit about. Throughout my career, it didn't take long for the word to get around on training that was just ridiculous and a joke, and they sort of went by the wayside because it wasn't impactful. And I can tell you that the training I personally went to that your office put together, we received excellent reviews on that. It was very impactful for a four-hour training course, and that as I've said before, that's the kind of training I would like to see other entities mirror and mimic, because the officers themselves said, this is something I can really use.
Mr. Jay, I was not fishing for a compliment, just to be clear. So I guess
I was there.
I just want to make sure that's clear. So I guess the follow-up question then is in terms of the legislature, because there's been a lot of talk about the content of training, as you know, various kinds, various issues, just, you know, the community, and media, et cetera. Then it seems like the way the legislature then can direct some attention to particular trainings that we might want to is by choosing a topic and directing funding towards, such as UMCPI, as you mentioned, others. Is that just sort of, if you can comment as the last piece, just strategically, if there are pieces that we want to go out, and I'm sure this will be in the chair's bill, but how about how we do that, given that the post board's role is not to be, as you say, a censor of training content? Thank you.
Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, that's correct. The agencies, Upper Midwest and others that have carried out and sort of contracted with the state and the Post Board to carry out this training have done an excellent job, not only in delivering the training regionally to get it outside of, to certainly offer it in the metro, but to get it out to the far reaches of the state so there's less travel time, et cetera, for agencies to send their officers to. So that is a way to direct it if there are specific topics. The Post Board itself is not a training provider.
Okay. Thank you. Now, Representative Frankie and then Representative Consta, and if we could end it there and then move into the sentencing guidelines, because I know Nathan Wrights is anxious to be grilled. Director. Representative Frankie has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director, I have a question that we haven't really addressed here that I think, so the Post Board is down 15 or 5 FTEs itself. Now, my question is that impacting your ability to oversee, track, update, and the requirements that are put forth to our police officers? And is this due to cutbacks, innovation, has this, you know, hindered your ability to do your job?
Director.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Frankie, I certainly have a current proposal, and we do have a strategic plan where we are trying through some technological changes. For instance, tracking CEs is something that we brought back. So I know that the Post Board, it was long before my time, lost people during budget difficulties, and we are upgrading to systems that are certainly increasing our efficiency, and I'm not suggesting I need five people back, but there will be times in the future where I will be asking to get specific directed positions back to ensure that we are meeting all of the different sort of regulatory and resource needs that everybody wants from us. So fortunately, I just have arrived at some good time when some of our systems are being upgraded, computer systems, which is specifically helping with the CEs, as Representative Johnson talked about.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Considine will wrap it up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do the use of force training, is there a live fire component to those? The reason I'm asking is that I look across some of the tragedies across the nation, my belief is that a lot of those have to do with training more than necessarily having bad officers. So I'm kind of wondering if they have an actual opportunity to shoot.
The director.
Mr. Chair, Representative Considine, yes, there is a live fire. In fact, for handgun, there's a 50-round minimum requirement for a qualification training, among other areas of use of force, before hopefully one has to use their firearm. And I can tell you, though, that when you talk about training costs and why we're trying to direct more funding towards law enforcement ongoing training is ammunition is expensive, as particular one area, and that is reported to us as their cost. That goes into the total training cost, not just the tuition. So, yes, there is a requirement for minimum rounds that are expended.
Okay. Thank you very much, Director, for your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
We'll probably see you again on the budget. Dig in.
I was only
going
to go 15 minutes.
We have two Nates in the same day here.
Yep.
We have Nathaniel Wrights.
That's correct.
Executive Director of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission Overview. And go ahead, sir, state your name and title and begin.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, I am Nate Wrights, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. Thank you for this opportunity to present the committee with an overview of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. In 1980, Minnesota became the first state to implement a sentencing guidelines structure. The Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission is a legislatively created body whose purpose is to establish and improve the Minnesota sentencing guidelines, evaluate outcomes of changes in sentencing policy, analyze trends, make appropriate recommendation, and provide education on sentencing law and policy. When the commission establishes sentencing guidelines or modifies sentencing guidelines, the legislature has made it clear that its primary consideration is public safety. Other considerations are current sentencing and release practices, correctional resources, including but not limited to the capacities of local and state correctional facilities, and the long-term negative impact of crime on the community. The Commission has stated that the purpose of the sentencing guidelines is to establish rational and consistent sentencing standards that reduce sentencing disparity and ensure that the sanctions imposed for felony convictions are proportional to the severity of the conviction of the conviction offense and the offender's criminal history. So the principles embodied in the sentencing guidelines include that sentences should be uniform, they should be predictable, consistent, rational, and neutral, and that departures from the presumptive sentences should only be made when substantial and compelling circumstances can be articulated. Now, most of these considerations cannot be measured, but some of them can. Uniformity and correctional capacity can arguably be measured. With respect to uniformity, our data show that 72% of felony cases sentenced in 2015 were sentenced in accordance with the presumptive sentence recommended by the sentencing guidelines. That's the green portion of the pie chart on the left. With respect to correctional capacity, Minnesota's 2015 imprisonment rate, although higher than in past years, is the third lowest among all 50 states. And if you go back over the 36 years that the sentencing guidelines have been in effect, you'll find that over those 36 years, in 35 of those years, Minnesota's imprisonment rate was among the three lowest in the nation among all the other states in every year except 2014, where it was the fourth lowest. And the chart on the right compares Minnesota's 2015 imprisonment rate, which is 196 per 100,000 residents of the state, with the four lowest states in the nation, the four neighboring states, and the four highest states in the nation. The red bar represents the national imprisonment rate, which is just over half, I'm sorry, just over twice Minnesota's imprisonment rate. During this presentation, I'd like to begin by presenting an overview of the sentencing guidelines, particularly for those who may be new to the committee. I'd like to describe ongoing commission activity and end with current sentencing practices to the extent time permits. As I stated, the purpose of the sentencing guidelines is to establish rational and consistent standards that reduce sentencing disparity and ensure that proportional sentences, proportional to the felony convictions and the offender's criminal history.
Director? Yes, I was just going to, sorry for the interruption. We've got a load of slides to go through, so if you could write down your questions and ask them at the end so we can get through the presentation, that'll be okay, instead of jumping in. Otherwise, we'll never get to the end, I think. Unless it's something really drastically important. Go ahead, Director.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the idea of uniformity is that people with similar criminal records and similar types of crime should receive similar sentences. The idea of proportionality is that people with criminal histories that are severe and offenses that are severe should receive severe sanctions and vice versa. So the way the guidelines implement those concepts is that they take the severity of the crime and then they take the offender's criminal history and custody status. So they look at the crime, they look at the offender, and with those two factors they come up with a presumptive sentence. Before the legislature created the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, there were no uniform standards regarding what should be included or could be included in an offender's criminal history, no weighting format to distinguish among different types of offenses, and no systematic process to check the accuracy of the information in the criminal history. The conviction offense is the primary factor under the guidelines. Criminal history is a secondary factor in those dispositional departure decisions. The legislature defines the offenses and establishes penalty ranges in the statute, and guided by that information, past sentencing practices, and other factors, the Guidelines Commission assigns severity levels to all the different felony offenses. Criminal history is comprised of four different elements: the prior felony level offenses, custody status at the time the current offense is committed, prior eligible misdemeanor and gross misdemeanor offenses can participate in the criminal history score, and in some cases, juvenile offenses can add to the criminal history score. And so those determine, crime severity, criminal history, determine both whether or not an offender is recommended to go to prison, and that's the disposition, or probation instead, and second, the length of the prison sentence that is recommended. In Minnesota, these are determinate sentences. That is, they're prison sentences with a defined length that can't be changed by a parole board or other agency. This results in a fixed sentence that is known up front and isn't subject to the discretion of a parole board, unlike an indeterminate sentencing system which existed before the sentencing guidelines. The judge makes the ultimate decision concerning the sentence. There are multiple sources that inform those sentencing decisions, victims, prosecutors, probation officers make a recommendation in the pre-sentence investigation report and inform the court of what the guidelines recommend, and defense attorneys. And in many, many cases, we see that prosecutors and defense attorneys reach plea agreements in most cases, and those plea agreements inform the court as to what the sentence should be. The court may accept or reject the plea agreement or pronounce a sentence that is a departure from the sentencing guidelines if substantial and compelling circumstances exist. So this next slide talks about a general overview of what the sentencing guidelines grid looks like. And you do have, at the end of your handouts, the three sentencing grids that are in effect currently. We've got the standard grid, the sex offender grid, and new last year we have the drug offender grid. This is the standard grid shown here. It's a two-dimensional grid. The horizontal axis is the severity of the offense. So that's assigned by the Guidelines Commission in the manner I described earlier. And then the horizontal axis is the criminal history of the offender. The greater the offense severity and the greater the criminal history, the more likely an offender is to be recommended to go to prison, and the longer that duration is. The gray area of the grid is a recommended stayed prison sentence in most cases, although mandatory minimums may play a part in recommending prison sentence, notwithstanding being in the gray area of the grid. The white area of the grid is the recommended executed prison sentence. And the durations, the numbers are months that the Guidelines Commission, that the sentencing guidelines recommend for a particular offender with that offense severity and that criminal history. There's a range of months in those white cells that the judge can sentence an offender to without departing from the guidelines. That's 15% below the presumptive sentence and 20% above the presumptive sentence. If the judge were to sentence to prison when probation were recommended, or probation when prison were recommended, or were to sentence to a duration that was higher or lower than that shown in the grid, that would be a departure from the sentencing guidelines. So there are two different types of departures. To depart from the guidelines, the sentencing judge must articulate substantial and compelling circumstances. And those that finding of substantial and compelling circumstances can be appealed, and in some cases the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court will reverse a sentence if those findings are not adequate. That is different than some states where the guidelines are more purely advisory. In this case, the guidelines process must be followed, and that process includes the finding of substantial and compelling circumstances. There are two types of departures: dispositional departures, as I described before, the go to prison or don't go to prison decision, and an aggravated dispositional departure is a sentence to prison when the stayed sentence was recommended. A mitigated dispositional departure is a stayed sentence when prison was recommended. Likewise, there are durational departures. An aggravated sentence is over 20% longer than the recommended duration. A mitigated durational departure is a sentence that is more than 15% shorter than the recommended duration. In cases of a departure, the sentencing judge completes a departure report and submits it to the Sentencing Guidelines Commission within 15 days after sentencing, and we compile those data as we do with all felony sentencing data. Although a plea agreement is not by itself a sufficient basis for departure, we do find that most departures are supported by agreement of the parties, and that's indicated on those departure reports. So here's an example of a hypothetical offender. This offender committed a home burglary, second-degree burglary, which has been assigned a severity level of 5 by the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. This particular offender has a criminal history score of 3. He got that because he previously had committed a non-home burglary, third-degree burglary, and he's on probation for that at the time he commits the new residential burglary. So because he's on probation, that's considered custody status, so he has a custody status point. So that moves him one row to the right on the grid. In addition, he has a felony point from that non-residential burglary. So he has the custody status point for being on probation for that offense. He also has the criminal history point, the felony point, for having committed that crime previously. In addition, he has an unrelated prior check forgery, which is also worth one felony point because it was over $2,500. So in this case, we'd look at the horizontal row 5. Well, I guess that would be vertical. So going up from the top to row 5 and then going to the right to column 3 and find the point of intersection, which is the square that indicates 33-month presumptive duration. So the presumptive sentence in this case would be a commit to the Commissioner of Corrections for 33 months. And under Minnesota's truth in sentencing law, the offender would have to serve 22 of those months in prison, and assuming he behaved in prison, would get to spend the last 11 months on supervised release under the jurisdiction of the Commissioner of Corrections. And Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to entertain any questions about how the guidelines operate at this point, if or I could move on as well.
Any questions?
So the next few slides will cover some of the recent and ongoing work that the Commission has done and is doing. First, let me talk about the composition of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. The 11-member Sentencing Guidelines Commission is responsible for the agency's policy role, and they are the sole source of policy from the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. The Professor Richard Fraze at the University of Minnesota described a major goal of the guideline system was that it be designed and monitored by an independent sentencing commission to ensure that sentencing policy formulation and modification is data-driven, comprehensive across crimes and judicial districts, and insulated from short-term political pressures. Excuse me. The commission's three judicial members are appointed by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. They're indicated in orange. Those are currently the Chief Justice's designee. That has historically been a Supreme Court justice. Currently, that is the Honorable Christopher Dietzen, who is recently retired from the Supreme Court, but was appointed as a retired justice by the Chief Justice. In addition, the chair is appointed by the governor, and Justice Dietzen was appointed by Governor Dayton to be the chair of the sentencing guidelines during this term of the governor. And he's the first member of the commission who was appointed by the by both branches of government. The appeals court judge is the Honorable Heidi Shellhaus of the Court of Appeals. The district court judge is the Honorable Carolyn Lennon out of the 1st District, out of Scott County, is where she's chambered. The public defender is the chief appellate public defender for the state, Catherine Middlebrook. The county attorney is Washington County Attorney Peter Orpett. You heard from Commissioner Roy, I believe, yesterday. He is a member of the commission as the Commissioner of Corrections. Our peace officer representative is Sergeant Paul Ford of the St. Paul Police Department. Our probation officer representative is Valerie Estrada. She and Mr. Orpett were recently appointed to the commission. That seat had been vacant for more than a year, so I'm happy to say that we now have our full complement of 11 members of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and she is a career probation officer with Hennepin County Probation Office. There are three public members by statute on the commission. One of them must be a felony crime victim. Those three public members are Angela Champagne Fromm, Yemi Vang, and retired Judge Mark Warner. The commission's primary responsibility is to fulfill the guiding principles of the guidelines by considering ongoing modifications to the sentencing guidelines as needed. And I'll describe this modification process now. Some modifications to the guidelines must be submitted to the legislature before they are permitted to take effect. For example, this year, at the request of a prosecutor, the commission decided to reconsider the severity ranking of child neglect or endangerment. After a public hearing, the commission adopted a proposal to increase the severity level from 1 to 5. That change must be submitted to the legislature in January, and we did submit that to you as members of this commission in our report to the legislature, which you received on Friday. That change will only take effect on August 1st of 2017 if the legislature does not pass a law blocking that change, and that's pursuant to the statutory process that is currently in place. Not all modifications must be submitted to the legislature before they may take effect. Frequently, modifications are in response to new laws that are enacted during the preceding session. For example, in 2016, the legislature increased by 25% the statutory maximum penalty for certain assaults if they were motivated by bias. In response to that new law, the Sentencing Guidelines Commission created a new rule under the guidelines that the presumptive duration found on the grid must also be increased by 25% if that new statute applies. Because this change was in response to a crime that was created in the preceding legislative session, it did not require submission to the legislature before it could take effect. So it took effect on August 1st of 2016, which was the same day that the new law took effect. So they were able to both take effect at the same time. In addition to the guidelines modification process, the commission also has been given a statutory role of providing advice to the legislature. The legislature has asked the Sentencing Guidelines Commission periodically to make recommendations to the legislature regarding criminal law, criminal procedure, and sentencing in general. Regarding recent commission action, the commission in December 2015 proposed a new drug offender grid and drug rankings to the legislature. And this really isn't from this past year. This was submitted to the legislature in our annual report to the legislature in January of 2016. But as you know, there was legislative action on that, and ultimately a Drug Sentencing Reform Act was enacted. And in July of 2016, the commission incorporated those changes that were, in most cases, required by the legislature from that act into the sentencing guidelines. In November 2016, the commission clarified how criminal history weights should be assigned to earlier drug offenses. Going forward, the commission is currently studying the validity of how the guidelines calculate and use criminal history scores, making sure we're doing that the right way, and reviewing the purpose of criminal history scores and whether or not changes should be made to how those are calculated. In addition to the Commission's policy function, and in order to improve the quality of the Commission's policy decisions, there are the analysis and oversight roles of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission's agency staff. The legislature intends for the Commission to serve as a clearinghouse and information center for state and local sentencing practices. We do conduct ongoing research in sentencing practices, the guidelines, and other matters relating to the improvement of the criminal justice system. We also provide the legislature with the annual report on the guidelines and sentencing practices, which I'm going to get to in a minute, fiscal and racial impact notes, and we are happy to provide, if you have a bill coming and you're wondering whether it's going to have a prison bed impact, we'd be happy to talk with you about it if you want to ask us about that before introducing the bill. We'd be happy to do that. We give practitioners immediate sentencing guidelines guidance. We also provide practitioners with reports on departure rates for particular offenses in particular jurisdictions or however specific they want to get. That's part of our clearinghouse and information center role. And we review all 16,000 sentencing worksheets that are generated annually and the departure reports when applicable. In addition, the legislature recently gave us a new responsibility to analyze the impact of the new drug sentencing law. Unfortunately, as the law just took effect for crimes committed on or after August 1st of 2016, it's too early to be able to provide a report to the committee at this time, but that will be coming up as those data become available.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in your research on the sentencing guidelines changes that were made related to the changes that we just made on drug sentencing, will you be taking a look at all or considering fentanyl and carfentanil? We're starting to see more of those offenses, and fentanyl and carfentanil have, dosage. It's such a higher concentration that when you see those cases, they might be 100 times stronger than the heroin, or and whether or not those should be somewhere or is that something that someone else should be taking a look at?
Director. Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, my analysis of the requirements of the new law were such that I asked for an additional half a research analyst. And part of the reason I asked for a half a research analyst was because I believe that we're going to have to really effectively look at the impact of the drug law. We're going to have to look at criminal complaints and read those criminal complaints, which is something we don't do. Right now we just look at the sentencing data in the aggregate, code it, and move on. But we're going to have to look at the criminal complaints to see if they reveal what the drug was and what the quantity of the drug was, both in the past and moving forward. So I think because of the legislature's giving us that extra half a research analyst, I'm hopeful that we will have some of that information going forward, provided that information is to be found in the criminal complaint. Sometimes it's, as you know, Representative Hillstrom, different prosecutors have different philosophies as far as writing criminal complaints and how much detail they put in those criminal complaints. But to that extent, that information is readily available in the criminal complaints. I hope that we will be able to provide some information about drug types and drug quantities to a greater degree than we have in the past.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hope that you will because, as you know, we've been hearing a lot about overdoses and many of the overdoses we're hearing about in the media and some with some very famous people have to do with fentanyl and carfentanil and the strength that brings in addition to the opioid.
Okay, Representative Dean, did you have one of these?
Yes, along these lines. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So along those same lines, is the alternative or the opposite true in that when we look at quantities, do we ever look at the purity? Because sometimes, you know, with heroin or other drugs, you know, in the process of wholesaling, going to retailing, oftentimes it will be cut 50% or 75% with some type of inert substance to increase the quantity, but at the same time, it actually lowers the potency as well.
Director. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dean, my experience, Representative Dean, is that because purity is not an element of any crime in the controlled substance law, that purity is not tested, and therefore would not show up on a criminal complaint. So I do not believe we will be able to give you any purity information.
Okay, Director, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is our staff that performs these functions. We work for the 11-member Sentencing Guidelines Commission. We have one executive director, one management analyst, and now we're back up to four research analysts after the 2016 law was passed. Mr. Chair, I don't know if there are any other questions about the commission's recent activity. I can move on then to current sentencing practices, if not.
Go ahead.
So last Friday, we submitted our annual report to the legislature, two committee members. That report highlighted some of our summary data from 2015. You can find more detailed data in your report to the legislature. You can find more detailed data than that in our annual summary report. And with respect to certain kinds of crimes, you can find more detail than that with respect to specialized reports that we also have on our website. These data that I'm going to be describing are from 2015. 2015 is the most recent year in which we have sentencing data available. Minnesota courts sentenced 16,763 felony offenders in 2015, which was an increase of 3.8% from 2014, and it was above the previous record high volume of 16,443, which was set in 2006. Nevertheless, as I testified earlier, Minnesota ranks among the states with the three lowest imprisonment rates in the nation. Compared with other states, Minnesota's imprisonment rate in 2015 of 196 prisoners per 100,000 Minnesota residents was less than half of the national state imprisonment rate. On the other hand, Minnesota's rate is rising, or has been rising, and the national state imprisonment rate is going in the other direction, falling. As a proportion of offenders sentenced, there's almost parity between the three major types of crimes, drug crime, property crime, and person crime. Person offenders, which includes sex offenders, accounts for 29.7% of offenders sentenced in 2015. Property offenders accounted for 27.3%, and drug offenders accounted for 29.3%. In the other smaller categories, felony DWIs accounted for 3.5%. Non-criminal sexual conduct sex offenses accounted for 2.8%. That would be, for example, predatory offender registration. Weapons offenses, which is a new category that we're tracking, accounted for 2.8%. And other offenses accounted for 4.5%.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So going back to that slide with the weapons offense, so there was case law that stated that no longer is a BB gun that's a CO2 gun is no longer a firearm. That just occurred, and so it created felons who were previously in possession of those offenses now can carry them, and it's not no longer a felony felon in possession. Would this chart take that case law impact into effect? I'm not sure if they, you know, let people out that had previously been sent to prison that were convicted of that offense when it's not really a crime anymore. Do you know?
Director, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, so we did discuss this issue at last week's Sentencing Guidelines Commission meeting. I don't know that we have data on this yet, but obviously we have a number of subject matter experts on the commission, and the consensus seemed to be that people are getting relief, whether they be in prison or otherwise, for past felon in possession offenses where the weapon was a BB gun. The as far as our data, we don't change the data even if someone has been later exonerated or a sentence has been vacated. We have not historically gone back and updated the data. So I think we might be able to make a note on that on our reports, but historically, that's not how we've operated. We close the book on 2015 and move on, essentially.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you know then who would be the proper entity to keep us informed about how many? For members that don't know, it's a mandatory commit for 60 months to the Commissioner of Corrections if you're a felon in possession of a firearm. And it was the law that if you possessed a CO2 cartridge handgun or other gun, that was a firearm under the statute. That was changed this year by the court, changing the definition. So at some point, this body should find out how many people were let out, because I assume we might see some claims for money under the exoneration statute. I think there may be some other consequences that come. So if you're not the right agency, any idea who might be?
Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I think the Department of Corrections could tell you about how many, if any, prisoners have been released because they were imprisoned for felon in possession of a BB gun. And I think the courts could tell you whether or not, they might be able to tell you, I'm not sure, whether or not sentences have been vacated or dismissed. I don't know whether they'd be able to tell you exactly why without looking at each individual case, which would be pretty burdensome. Anecdotally, we've gotten at least some questioning from practitioners. We take guidelines calls all the time, every day, all day, on how to implement the guidelines or how to apply it in a particular case. And in some cases, but not too terribly many, there have been questions about what to do about a criminal history score, adjusting a criminal history score or a custody status point in the event of a sentence that was vacated. So a previous BB gun on the criminal record, but now that's being vacated, so what to do about that? Hasn't come up a lot, but that's really anecdotal, and if it is vacated and it doesn't show up on the sentencing worksheet, then we won't have the data to track. It'll just be a non-event for us.
With the background in prosecutors that we've got, it'd be interesting. The rumor is that prosecutors usually use possession of a firearm by a felon as a bargaining tool and don't often charge it. I don't know if that's true or not. The sheriffs, one of our big sheriffs, said that there's a lot of them aren't even charged, or when they do, it's pled down to something else. Now, have you run into that or heard about that much? So I was wondering what a big impact that would have to begin with.
Well, Mr. Chair, personally, I had three cases pending that were CO2 that were dismissed. So I can tell you that the county I am currently on leave for definitely charged those, and I personally had to dismiss three felon in possession cases because of it.
Well, I mean dismissed without that being a factor before this determination.
No.
Supposedly. The charge, but then dismissed later and pled to something else.
Mr. Chair, I believe the sentencing guidelines keeps track of a report that counties have to put together about when there's a firearm involved in a crime and when those get departures or when. So I believe that there is a report that somebody collects already. So we could get that for you.
Yeah. You're right.
Go ahead, Director. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom is correct that each of the 87 county attorneys is required to submit to the Sentencing Guidelines Commission every year what they did in the preceding fiscal year with certain crimes that involved a firearm. And we are required to submit that report to you as part of our report to the legislature. So you will find in your report to the legislature one of the sections in that is essentially the county attorney's report. So it's not our data. It's the only part of that report that's not our data, but it is as reported by the county attorneys. And on this chart, you'll see the weapons do take up, again, we're tracking that separately as a new category, do take up 2.8% of all felonies sentenced in 2015. That does include felon in possession or other weapons-related offenses such as discharge of a firearm. This chart shows the percent change in the number of offenders sentenced for felony convictions from the early 80s to date. And you'll see in some years the bar goes below the zero line, so there would be a drop in the number of offenders sentenced. In most years, though, there's a rise in offenders sentenced, and that's been true in the last 5 years. There's been at least some rise in the in the number of offenders who are sentenced for felony convictions. This chart breaks down that change by offense type. You can see that there's been an increase in the drug category. That was the largest increase in the last 2 years, other than the other category, which we saw a pretty high increase in. That's a pretty small category, though. Felony DWI has been remarkable in its inconsistency over the past 3 years. It went down 19% in 2013, went up 28% in 2014, and then went down again 10% in 2015. We speculate that some of that may be due to the legal uncertainty in the DWI field that's been prevalent over the last few years, and perhaps that affected the timing of felony DWI charging. This slide, slide 23, shows the distribution of offenders by race or ethnicity over time. And again, this is the entire period of time, essentially, that the guidelines have been in effect. The percentage of offenders who are white has decreased by roughly 25% since 1981. The percentage of offenders who are black has increased slightly in the last year from 2014 to 2015. From 25.8% to 26.3%, which brings it back almost exactly to the percentage that it was at in 2013.
The percentage who are white decreased slightly from in those same 2 years, 2014 to 2015, from 58.5% to 57.7%. The percentage who are American Indians increased slightly, while the percent who are Hispanic or Asian remained the same from 2014 to 2015.
Mr. Chair, you just said that the African-American incidences changed slightly percentage-wise, but it's actually a significant change. It's, as I look at it, it seems like it's at 50%. So can you clarify what you meant by slightly?
As a distribution of all offenders, 26.4% were black in 2013. These are felony offenders. 25.8% were black in 2014, and then 26.3% were black in 2015, which is very close to the 2013 level. So whether that change from 26.4 to 25.8 to 26.3 is a slight change is I guess that's not a scientific characterization. So
okay, and Mr. Chair, I need to apologize because I looked at the chart and I look at from 81 all the way, and it's a huge shift. And since you were presenting sort of the chart from 81, I think it's important to actually be cognizant and recognize the significant changes that have happened within the black community, the Hispanic community, and the African or the American Indian community as well.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, that is correct. The chart does depict something different than what I was talking about. I was talking about the most recent year's change. The chart gives the committee the information going all the way back to the advent of the guidelines. The distribution of felony offenders by race varied by judicial district in 2015. The largest populations of black offenders were to be found in the 2nd Judicial District, which is the same as Ramsey County, and the 4th Judicial District, which is the same as Hennepin County. Blacks make up just under half of the offenders sentenced in Ramsey, and actually over half in Hennepin. In the 9th Judicial District, American Indians were almost a third of the offender population, and the largest population of Hispanic offenders was to be found in the 8th Judicial District, where they made up 16% of offenders. In Ramsey County, the Asian population comprised just under 10% of the offender population in that judicial district. Again, that's the 2nd Judicial District. On slide 25, you'll see the total incarceration rates. In 2015, the total incarceration rate was 91.8%, meaning almost 92% of offenders who were sentenced for a felony offense got some sort of incarceration, be that local jail time or state prison time. 26.2% of the offender population got prison time. When comparing imprisonment, so this chart, and I'm afraid we're going to run out of time for questions, Mr. Chair, but this chart shows the total incarceration rates by gender and ethnicity. There is a distinct difference between the male and female populations. I would just advise the committee in reading this chart to note that the types of crimes and the criminal histories are not uniformly distributed across races or genders. So some of the differences that we see in total incarceration and state prison rates are attributable to the different types of offense severities and attributable to the different criminal histories. Slide 27 breaks this down by judicial district. The 2nd Judicial District in Ramsey County had the highest total incarceration rate, and the 3rd Judicial District had the lowest at 91% and 82%. The 8th and 4th Judicial Districts had the highest imprisonment rates, and the 5th and 6th Judicial Districts had the lowest imprisonment rates. With regard to the use of local confinement, the 2nd Judicial District in Ramsey County had the highest rate at 71.7%, and the 3rd Judicial District had the lowest rate at 57.6%. So this slide talks about the length of the prison sentences that were pronounced when a prison sentence was pronounced, and the average amount of local confinement pronounced as an interim sanction. So when somebody did not go to prison. The average pronounced prison sentence in 2015 was 45 months, which is a slight decrease over 2014. And I think historically is pretty consistent with what we've seen since about 1990. It's been, for the most part, somewhere in the 40s. And 45 months is not that different from what it has been. The average amount of local confinement pronounced as an interim sanction was 105 days in 2015, which is very close to 2014. And that's remained largely constant since 1988. Now we're moving on to departure rates. This is a larger version of the chart you saw at the very beginning, which indicates that in most cases, there's no departure. The guideline sentence was the sentence that the judge imposed, whether that's stayed or commit. In 5% of the cases, there was an aggravated departure, 22% a mitigated departure, and in 1% of the cases, a mixed departure. So maybe an aggravated duration, a mitigated disposition, or vice versa.
Director, violating my own rule here about answering questions, but it's getting late.
I know.
I don't mean who is at fault for us, because it's not a fault, but who is the propagator, if that's the right word, of the variance usually of the sentence. Now, who do you put more responsibility of the variance on? Is it a deal where the plea agreement is made between the public defender or defense attorney and the county attorney, and then that's given to the judge, and the judge usually agrees with it? Or is the judge responsible for the variance if you do have a variance? Who's usually responsible for that variance or has the most control over it?
Mr. Chair, ultimately the buck stops with the judge, but you are correct when you in the first part of your question, most of these are the product of essentially a three-way agreement between the prosecutor, the defense attorney, and the judge as to what the appropriate sentence is given the case. So in the majority of cases where there is a departure, it is noted on the departure report that there is an agreement with the prosecutor, the judge, and the defense attorney.
Is it fair to say once the judge has seen the pre-sentence investigation, which is called a PSI, I don't know if it's still called that, but and then the agreement between the county attorney and the defense attorney, that there's not much de-ratifying or canceling it and saying, no, this is the way I want it done, they usually stick with that, or is that not a fair assumption?
Mr. Chair, I don't think our data show that. So we only get what the result was. We don't get to be in party to the process by which that result came about. So I don't think I have the data to answer that question. I think you'd have to ask practitioners, prosecutors, defense attorneys, or judges
that
question.
That's something maybe we can get into in the future, but rather than take up the last 5 minutes of it, but just curious. Go ahead.
All right. So slide 30 talks about dispositional departure rates with and without the request from the defendant. Most aggravated dispositional departures, that is going to prison, even though the guidelines said you don't have to go to prison, most of those are requests for prison from the defendant, where they're asking to go to prison for whatever reason. Sometimes there's another case, and they'd like to just get it over with. Sometimes they don't want to be on probation. This is the dispositional departure rate broken down by gender and ethnicity. I'll stand for questions on this if there are any, but I think we better move on. This is the dispositional departure rate by judicial district. These are the offenses, the six offenses where we see the highest mitigated dispositional departure rate, that is, a sentence to a stayed sentence despite the guidelines presumption for prison, Those are second-degree assault, assault with a dangerous weapon, predatory offender, failure to register. Both of those have statutory mandatory minimums. There's also a burglary in the first degree at the severity level 8. There are two types of burglary. Second-degree drug offenses, fifth-degree drug offenses, and felony DWI. The overall mitigated dispositional departure rate is 34%, which is shown on the blue line. Now we're moving on to durational departures. Again, this chart on 34 is breaking it down by gender and race. This is only applying to executed prison sentences where somebody got longer or shorter than the guidelines call for when they went to prison. And then this is the same broken down by judicial district, slide 35. These are the offenses with the highest durational departure rates. For aggravated durational departures, that is longer than the guidelines called for, and again, this could be part of a plea agreement, we see assault in the first degree and assault in the third degree. The total aggravated departure rate is very low, 3%. The total mitigated durational departure rate is 25%, and the highest five offenses that we saw in 2015 were domestic assault, first-degree controlled substance, predatory offender, failure to register, aggravated robbery in the first degree, and burglary in the first degree, this being the severity level 6 version of that offense. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Subject to your questions, that concludes the overview.
Director, a question, if I don't know if it's philosophical or what, but sometimes when you folks are meeting in the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, the phrase comes up, the judges aren't following these recommendations anyway. They're departing, and that's given as an excuse or reason, not an excuse, to lower the sentences to match the judges' big variance. Unless it was misquoted in the paper, that's what I read. It's something about, well, nobody's paying attention to these. The judges, anyway, they're varying so far, and maybe we have to adjust it because the judges aren't using it. Is that a good judge of what we should be doing? And I mean, an estimation of how we should, just because the judges, what's your opinion on that? Is that a factor that we have to consider? Or because you naturally get the public saying, on one end, throw them all in jail, which we can't do. And on the other end, they're varying so much from the sentences, and you folks are trying to find the right place in the middle. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. So the presumptive sentence under the sentencing guidelines is intended to cover the typical case. The reason for a departure in the guidelines is to handle the atypical case, a case that is more serious or less serious, either in terms of the offense or the offender, than the typical case. And there are a number of reasons for departures, and again, those reasons can be appealed by a party that feels aggrieved by that departure. I can't speak for the commission. There are 11 members of the commission, and they alone set the policy, but it is possible that in the past some commission members have believed that if there is a high departure rate, that suggests that judges believe that most offenses, for example, are atypical, then that might bring in a reasonable commission member's mind the question, are the guidelines themselves accurately describing what the typical offense is worth under these circumstances?
The last question I have is, what's your protocol for voting on your board? Recently you took a vote whether it was going to be retroactive or not in the drug sentence. I'm probably terming this wrong from what actually happened, but the recent vote you took, do you folks take recorded votes? And if you don't, do you have rules the same as ours where one of the either party can say they called for a roll call vote and it has to be recorded, or how are your votes taken? Or just a voice vote and then it's guess the majority, or do you roll call and count?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We use Robert's Rules of Order in our meeting, so if a member of the commission feels that the chair is not accurately recording the vote, he or she can request a division or a voice vote. At our most, not our most recent meeting, but at our December 30th meeting, we had some people calling in. They were on vacation on December 30th, and so by statute, we were required to do roll call votes for all votes. So all votes are recorded for that meeting.
Oh, okay. Members, unless somebody's got a question, we're at the noon hour. And by the way, when I ask the questions about county attorneys, all I'm trying to do is find, they had this big CARE 11 thing lately, and they're doing this study on sentencing and variances. So I was just trying to find out, because they asked me the question. I didn't really know, you know, where the final, you know, reason was. So, okay, if there's no more questions, thank you very much for your presentation. It's very informative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, meeting adjourned.